Okay, it's credible that someone might go, you're a Republican too. Maybe I believe there's a logical proposition that you're more trustworthy. Yeah, maybe. But the idea that people genuinely believe, I'm 5'10", you're 5'10", you're more trustworthy. Like, that's not a logical... no one believes in that sense. So it's an affinity towards someone who is similar.
Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about the deep values of those shaping our common life. We have had a really rich and interesting series, and today you're going to listen to an episode in which I reflect on those conversations with the help of a guest. I was really delighted to welcome John Yates today. John has worked in community projects. He worked at McKinsey as a consultant. He founded a youth charity, and he is now the executive director of the Youth Endowment Fund, which helps prevent children and young people getting involved in violence. And I asked him in particular because he's also the author of a book, Fractured, Why Our Societies Are Coming Apart and How We Can Put Them Back Together, which really underpins a lot of my thinking about division and polarization and what we can do about it. We had a really lovely reflect together, and I really hope you enjoy listening to it. John, you have had this fascinating career in a bunch of different places in the third sector, but you haven't spent your whole life working on division or peace building or reconciliation or any of these topics that we more perhaps obviously associate with the kind of things you're writing in your book. So why did you get interested?
I sort of feel like, why wouldn't you be interested in like division? It feels a bit like I like football. I'm like, why wouldn't you like football? It's like an amazing game. We're all surrounded by humans, so I find it like an obvious thing to be sort of intrigued by, like who is friends with who accepts who. But like, if I was being sort of slightly sort of self-analytical, I think there's probably two things that sort of true of me as a kid that sort of made me more likely to be sort of obsessed with this stuff. So one was, like, when I give a talk, I often say I'm going to lead with a confession. And, like, my confession is I was never cool at school. And I often sort of tell people that the fact I was not cool is, like, super mysterious. And by that I mean not that it's a surprise that I wasn't cool, but, like, there's so many reasons why I might not have been cool that it's kind of a mystery as to which one did it.
In the complex status unspoken hierarchies.
So was it the fact my dad was a vicar? Was it that I had ginger hair? Was it that I used to have a lisp? Largely gone, not entirely. Was it that I was way too academic to be sort of socially acceptable? Was it that I was just totally useless at sport? It could have been any of them. Who did it? And that sort of not being terribly cool makes you sort of interested as to, like, why are certain people friends with certain people and how does that work? And why am I with, like, so I was very fortunate. I had a group of mates at school who I love and I stay very close to now, who I very much chose, but they were so like me. We were all, like, super uncool together. And it was only as we got older, we realised, oh, wow, we're now the uncool people, but we love being with each other. And it just made me sort of intrigued about the whole thing. I think the sort of bit that then sort of turbocharged it a bit, there's, even in my uncoolness, there were people less cool. And there was one kid in my class who no one ever sat next to. And it used to just burn at me. I would just see this empty chair next to this boy. And every day I felt like sort of, this is not right. Like, this is not, this person is like me. I felt like I was complicit in like some awful thing. And eventually I said to my friends, right, that's it. I'm drawing up a rota. We're going to take turns sitting next to this boy. And they were all like, oh, Yates, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're going to make us even less cool. What are you doing to us? But I just could, and it did make us less cool, but I just couldn't stand it. And so that sense of like acceptance and being part of something, it really sort of triggers something in me.
Yeah. And then what tipped you into, actually, I need to spend several years deep in the data and the theory about this in order to write a book about it? Was there one inciting incident?
So I spent about 10 years delivering like local community programs with children from all sorts of walks of life. And I remember we had a board who sort of, it's a charity, but a board sort of, I remember going to the board to like explain the next thing I thought we should do. And this was like pre-Trump, pre-Brexit. And I said, look, I think one of the reasons we have to do more to bring people from different backgrounds together is I think this is really bad for our democracy that we're so divided. I think it's dangerous. And they looked at me like I was a mental. They were just like, what are you talking? Look at this grandiose John with his big idea. He's running a program of a few thousand children. Now he's trying to save the Western world. What a moron. I mean, they don't say that. But you could tell they thought this was like I was over intellectualizing. I was over. And it got me kind of annoyed because I was like, but it's so obvious. And obviously, after Trump was elected and after Brexit happened, suddenly everyone was like, oh, it's because we're divided. And I think I felt a bit like that annoying person who feels they've seen something and desperately needs to sort of be heard. And so it was a book I wrote. You know, I find writing really hard work. And so I didn't always enjoy writing the book, but I had to write it. I just had to feel like I put it out there. I've done my best. This is what's going on.
Yeah. And my understanding is what you found is that we're not imagining it, that we're pretty divided, right? What were your kind of key findings around the ways we're living together?
Yeah, so what you see is that we tend to spend a lot of time with people who are quite similar to us. And so if you've got a university degree, it's more than likely that most of your friends also have university degrees. When you look at people who are retired across the Western world, the vast majority have no contact with anyone under the age of 40 in a normal month, unless it's their family. When you look at the referendum, the EU referendum, a quarter of people who voted Remain had no friends who voted Leave. A quarter of people who voted Leave had no friends who voted Remain. Ethnicity, half of all Brits have no friends from a different ethnic background. And classes or income, whatever you want to call it, is like the most telling one. When you look at the data on who people spend time with, if you're a barrister, let's say in London, so if you're sort of the top socioeconomic class, how many people would you have to invite round to your house in your sort of network friendship group before you would stumble across someone who was unemployed? 10, 20? Well, the answer is 100. And so the data gives you a pretty clear picture that actually we tend to spend time with people like us. And I think the point I always wanted to make to people is, there's some good stuff with that, right? So I like The West Wing, which for those who've never heard of it, it's like a political geek's, like, you know, exciting place to be. It's like a fictional drama about politics. People who hate politics shouldn't have to suffer me talking about it. There should be spaces where people who are similar talk and spend time. That's not necessarily by itself bad. The point I wanted to make was when it happens at a big level, you can end up with some really bad stuff happening. What the book lays out is it's dangerous for our democracy because you don't really understand each other and therefore you vote in a really uninformed way. And someone who comes along and says, well, the problem is all down to those baddies, it's really easy for that to happen because you don't even know those baddies. It's really bad for our health because you can get really anxious about the other and what they're up to and how organised and awful they are. And it's really bad for us from a social mobility point of view, but opportunities for children. What's the main way that people get jobs? It's often word of mouth. And so actually, if you're coming from a lower income, less opportunity background, you don't have those networks and your society is divided by income, well, it's going to continue to be very unequal. So that was the sort of main sort of cri de coeur. There's a problem. But it was trying to recognise, I think often what we do when we see a problem is we say, there must be an organised conspiracy that is causing this, the government plus whoever. And I think what I wanted to get across is, this is actually quite a natural thing that is happening. We just do, and we can feel it in ourselves, have a slight bias towards people like us. But if you leave it to its own devices, kind of bad stuff can happen.
So it was such a light bulb moment for me reading your book. And as you know, because I'm constantly tagging you into things, I quote you all the time because this quite obscure sounding like scientific theory, but it is incredibly measured, that scientists called homophily, which just means, you know, love of the same, love of people like us. You rebranded as PLM syndrome, people like me syndrome. And it has completely changed how I see the world. Because you're right, it's not like that's not something that we sort of know and it's codified in epigrams, right? You know, birds of a feather flock together, et cetera, et cetera. But your forensic laying out of just how much this affects almost every choice we make was very, very powerful for me. Could you just say a little bit more about what homophily is, white doesn't necessarily make us bad people, but the kind of places it shows up and some of the studies around it.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my favourites is there's this chap called Francis Evans, who in the 1950s got really obsessed with door-to-door salespeople. My first ever job was door-to-door sales, so it kind of appealed to me. And he followed 150 door-to-door salespeople across the United States, so knocking on doors, and they were selling life insurance. And he tracked whether they sold the life insurance or whether they didn't. And what he found was that they were significantly more likely to make a sale if the person opening the door on the other side voted the same way that they did. They were significantly more likely to make a sale if the person opening the door had earned the same amount of money as they did. They were more likely to make a sale if the person opening the door was the same height as they were. So what Evans has stumbled across is this slight bias towards people like me.
Presumably it's not like the salesman is saying, oh, by the way, I voted this way.
No, exactly.
There's just some like sense we have for sameness.
And the height one nails it because no one, like, okay, it's credible that someone might go, you're a Republican too, maybe I'll, you know, maybe I'll logically, maybe I believe there's a logical proposition that you're more trustworthy. Yeah, maybe. But the idea that people genuinely believe, I'm 5'10", you're 5'10", you're more trustworthy. Like, that's not illogical. No one believes in that sense. So it's an affinity towards someone who is similar. And you see it, there's thousands of studies that found the same way. The other one I love is a place called Waterhead Academy in Durham, in Oldham. And what it's a school made from two other schools. So there was a school called Breeze Hill in Count Hill, and one of those schools was almost entirely white British kids, and the other school was almost entirely Asian British kids. And they merged the two schools together, and they started to track who do the kids make friends with. And they did it by seeing who do they sit next to in the lunch hall, because that's where you choose who you can sit next to. And the first thing they found was that the white British kids and the Asian British kids were less likely to sit together. I didn't think that's that interesting, really, because they had been educated in different schools. But they also tracked a few other things, and they found that kids with ginger hair were more likely to sit next to kids with ginger hair, and kids with glasses were more likely to sit next to kids with glasses. I mean, I, as someone with ginger hair and glasses, was just thrilled that they had people to sit next to. But like the core insight again is there's this slight bias, and I think the best way to understand it, we get used to talking about racism and prejudice, which is sort of active hatred often. What I'm talking about here is a sense of fear of rejection that is less when someone seems similar. So what I mean by that is, let's say you go to some sort of social event and you walk in, and I see a group of people I don't know, but somewhere off to the right are a group of people wearing corduroy and they've got, you know, glasses on and they've got sort of middle-class accent and they're about my height. They're not super tall, so they don't terrify me. I might well wander over and join them. And the reason is I think they're less likely to say, what are you doing here? That's what we're talking about here. But done en masse, it starts to be problematic.
It's such a... One, it's embarrassing, isn't it? It's like a really embarrassing fact about humans. The way I put it in the book is we're like Narcissus scanning the world for fragments of our own reflection, right? How flipping self-obsessed can we be that basically the people we feel safest with are the people who are identical to ourselves. And then there's a sadness under that, right? Like there's something unstable in our sense of self and our ability to feel at home in the world if the further we get from our own reflection, the less safe we feel. Like that deep coding of difference as threat, as difference as danger, feels just like a sadness to me. And it is embarrassing. It's ridiculous. I was walking down a train the other day and I have this very particular brand of pen that I like and this very particular brand of notebook that I like. And I walk past someone using my brand of pen and my brand of notebook. And I swear my internal monologue went, they seem like a good person.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
What?
Yeah, that's exactly why it is. And I don't disagree with you, but let me sort of put a slightly more sort of sunny take on it.
Okay, go on.
Another way of looking at it is there are species of animal that don't bond together very much and don't. You know, what is amazing about humans is we're actually phenomenally good at trusting each other and cooperating. Like what makes the news is when we don't. But the news is the bit that's unusual, right? That's why it's news. Like, generally, we're actually very good cooperators. That's, you know, we're not the strongest, we're not the tallest, we're not the biggest, we're not the, you know, but we cooperate really well. So, like, actually, a different way of thinking about it is, isn't it amazing that humans who don't know each other, have never met, if they can spot something that they might think they have in common, it can be a vehicle to build a connection. Like, that's actually quite a positive trait. Now, the weakness is if we can only spot things in common with some people and not others, right? And if they all spot the same. But the opportunity is there. Because actually, the truth is, humans have lots of traits. And some of them we hold in common with most people. So I love football. Lots of people love football. Some hate football. I like politics. That's a completely different group of people. I have ginger hair. That's another group of people. I'm a Christian. That's another group of people. And I think what is really, if I was being sort of optimistic, I'd say what we need to be better at is finding places in our society that throw us together. Yeah. With people we didn't choose to hang out with, because then we'll soon spot the things we have in common.
Yeah.
And then hopefully we'll work to our advantage. So I'll give you an example. I did a year's employment for a charity that sent people overseas to do international development work. And there were a group of 12 of us in that group. Most of us were Westerners. There was one guy who was American by birth, but by heritage, Pakistani, Jawad, who is a Sunni Muslim. And we all rock up. Now, an outsider would say, John and Jawad don't have much in common. Homophily is going to play against them here because John's a committed Christian, Jawad's a committed Muslim. They've lived in very different parts of the world. Jawad and I got chatting, and Jawad starts complaining about how he finds it really irritating that a lot of people say they're Muslim, but they don't actually live as Muslim. They're just culturally Muslim. And he feels it's like taking the faith. And I'm like, oh, I couldn't agree with you more. It doesn't make a head in when people say, I'm a Christian, and they treat people so badly. And he was like, oh, yeah, there's this bit. Let me tell you about this bit in the Quran about how, like, people shouldn't pretend. And I'm like, oh, let me tell you about this bit in the Bible where they say the same thing. And then we would just, whenever something happened to the group, the two of us would have a chat and go, what do we do about this? And homophily brought us together. But it took something to spot the thing we had in common.
Yeah. And that's the argument that's so helpful in the book, that we actually need structures and shared institutions and shared stories to just like keep this at a healthy level, right? To not do what our society is doing, which is like continually reinforcing our people like me syndrome by both putting us in echo chambers in digital space, and demographically, you know, we're less likely to be in an office with people different from us. We're forgetting how to navigate that tension. And I think you talking about rejection is really helpful for me because, you know, I write a lot in the book about fight or flight, and the way difference can just tick us into slightly more anxious, slightly more tense space in our bodies. And that makes it hard to listen and hard to have empathy and hard to be actively looking for the thing we have in common, right? But the more we do it, the less it feels dangerous. And the less we do it, the more it feels dangerous. And that, you know, it's one of the things that Sacred's trying to do is like help listeners have the habit of listening to people not like themselves and feeling that thing in their body, which is like this. And I can feel it halfway through an interview sometimes where someone says something and I'm like, you know, oh, here we go. My shoulders just get a little bit tenser. Like we've hit the difference. We've hit the thing that we don't have in common. But the hope is that through listening deeply to their values and understanding where they've come from as a child and their story, I've given lots of opportunity for both me and the listener to find things in common or to find things that sound understandable.
Yeah, that's right. So like, I think there's two bits here. There's one which is like, how do we find ways to interact? Like if something seems dangerous, but it's actually not, right? So my kids sometimes do high ropes where, you know, you're up on this sort of rope high in the air, but you're attached to a harness. It looks dangerous. You think it's dangerous. It's not dangerous. And so one of my kids gets terrified by this. So I'm always saying to them, look, you're being told it's dangerous, but you've got to remember it's not. You've got to somehow overcome the fear. And the way to do it is broadly to do it, and then you realise it's not dangerous.
To prove it to yourself.
So that is what's the case with people who seem different from us. They're not dangerous. And so you have to somewhat put yourself in those positions. And that's why I'm always saying that join a club. you know, go four times. If you hate it, stop going and feel virtuous about what you did. But join a club, because you probably won't hate it and you'll get to meet some people. But one, we've got to put ourselves into those positions. I think the second thing to do, though, is that feeling of insecurity that comes. So when you're talking, I was chatting, like, I was at a thing the other day, I was chatting to someone who's way taller than me, massive, could absolutely, you know, lift me off the ground. And I could feel myself sort of pricking, like, you know, and I hear the monologue saying, he probably thinks I'm a bit of a loser because he's so massive and he's, you know, and I was like, but then I'm like, isn't that interesting? Look at that monologue. That's so funny. Why does my brain do that?
Hello, 12-year-old self that's still with me.
Yeah, and I'm like, that's cool. That's fun. Like, I think it's like being okay with that feeling. And knowing it's just a feeling, like feeling vertigo when you're on a rope. It's not real. And I think sometimes we think, if I feel insecure, it means I'm unsafe. Yeah. If I feel insecure, there's something wrong with me. No, it's just normal to sometimes feel insecure.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's fine.
And I think the temptation is to take that like low level semi-conscious anxiety and get angry and then direct the anger at the person we perceive to be making us feel unsafe, right?
100%.
And what we're living in is times that actually that response of externalizing into anger is really encouraged, right?
Yeah.
Is how it works for the algorithm. It makes us feel righteous.
100%.
So the reason I want to talk to you is we have been really pushing ourselves this series. Like last series, we were talking particularly about Fully Alive. And so I wasn't, as I'm usually picking guests that are kind of helping stretch me in different directions, that was much more about people who are prepared to talk to me about sin, frankly. And so this series, I was like, right, it's really important that we hold to this central mission of the podcast, which is listen across some really quite deep differences. So we've had Kate Thomas, who's a witch and a, she doesn't like the word medium, psychic, sort of, none of those words work. But anyway, Kate Thomas, you know, we've had Tim Winter, who's a Muslim. We've had Christians in James Martin and in Rod Dreher, who've come to radically different political and theological intuitions about things. Right then we had Daryl Davis, who, you know, is a black man who talks to the Klan. And it really was bringing up for me, both noticing it in myself and noticing in the audience, who we adore because they actually talk to us and reflect out loud about how things are going with them, just how much more emotionally challenging it's been as a series, right? Like, for wherever you're coming from, you will have likely listened to someone this series who you really did not want to listen to. And the number of people in the comments who've basically said things like, that was uncomfortable, I really struggled with that, like, I really didn't want to listen to that person. What this lovely comment says something about, like, I messed up my would-be tidy assumptions, which is exactly what we're wanting to do. You've listened to some of them. What stood out to you as kind of one of those differences that you thought was particularly interesting?
The thing that I found myself thinking about, like, is who is beyond the pale? Is anyone beyond the pale? Is anyone ever beyond the pale? Like, so my general view is, like, the woman who you spoke to, who, as for listeners who haven't listened to it, would call herself a witch. Like, we're not trying to be mean. Whose name is Kate?
Kate Thomas, yeah, Dr. Kate Thomas.
You know, I thought was, I mean, so easy to listen to, clearly highly intelligent, clearly, you know, cares a lot about what she's doing, cares a lot about people, has very strong sort of moral set of principles. I was thinking, like, if my children said, my kids are also teenagers of that sort of age, we're going to get a tarot reading done, I'm like, that's a terrible idea. I'm not going to let you do that. No way. And so, like, I was listening to you, and you're obviously someone with great empathy. You're someone who wants to listen. I was there going, oh, you ought to challenge her a bit. This is like, come on. I don't believe that she's psychic. I think this is potentially, I'm not saying she's doing it on purpose or anything. I think this is potentially exploitative. And I'm worried that as a person of Christian faith, I am worried about what you might be getting involved in with some of that stuff. So then I'm like, well, hang on, John. you also believe it's important to listen and to make space. And so, for example, when you had Rod Dreher on, am I saying his surname right?
Yeah.
Who is, you know, I wouldn't say he describes himself as a Trump supporter because he's not a big fan of the man, clearly, but he votes for Trump. And is comfortable living in Hungary, where most of lots of Hungarians are comfortable living in Hungary, but he's chosen to live in Hungary and very supportive of the way that country is being led, which a lot of people would say is quite anti-democratic. Quite sort of supportive of anti-immigrant sentiment. I can imagine people would complain and say, why have you given him airtime? I was like, good on you for giving him airtime. It's important we understand where he's coming from. I don't think his ideas are beyond the pale. I think it's important we listen to them. And so I was like, oh, what am I meant to feel about a woman who's promoting tarot reading? But I kind of felt there's something between the difference of this is a very sort of Christian concept, isn't it? The difference between the sin and the sinner, right? The difference between the person and what they're promoting. So I basically think no one should feel any duty to agree or support what I say. But I think people should feel a human duty to protect me as a human and treat me with respect. And I think it was like trying to work out where do you draw the line between, you know, a person who you want to treat the person with respect, but also their ideas you might want to challenge. And I find that a really interesting question.
Yeah. I mean, it's methodologically interesting for us because it is not what we do, right? Like there's loads of podcasts you can go to listen to, which are either kind of like buddy chats between people who really like each other and are helping each other promote their stuff, or debate shows, particularly on YouTube, where people have an argument and they challenge each other. The idea, and this is why, I mean, it is counterintuitive to people. The idea that you could listen to someone who you do not agree with purely for the sake of understanding them and not feel like it is your job in that moment to tell them why they're wrong isn't something I see a lot of. And it is the thing that people often misunderstand, that in listening without challenging, I am somehow promoting that we... And this is why I'm so interested in how we think about difference, right? Because my general commitment is that difference is not usually actually a threat. It is a gift. And that's partly kind of my theological doctrine of creation. And about how we grow, right? And what kind of communities flourish. They are often people with different gifts and different backgrounds and different sectors, how teams flourish in organizations, right? Like this safety, this knee-jerk need for safety in sameness or association of safety with sameness is fine in limited quantities, but is actually, I think, like leads us into bad places. And so I am trying to move towards difference, but I don't think listening is the same as affirming.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think so. The thing I was wondering, like, I was thinking, how else might I have done that? Because I was like, I would want to listen to this person I potentially disagree with, and absolutely, and I'd absolutely want to listen to something that I think might be wrong. I think the question is whether I might have wanted to say at the end, I'm not personally convinced by this. I personally still think X, Y, Z, but I so think we need to listen to it. And we were in a car the other day in the US on holiday, and this taxi driver spent half an hour telling me that this was a few months ago, that Biden was evil and that he was working with Chairman Xi from China and with a load of other people who have secretly run the world, including Bill Gates, to kill us all through COVID vaccines, right? And my kids are in the car. I'm like, I'm not going to take the guy on. What's the point? It's actually fascinating. And so I just asked him loads of questions. As we went out the car, my kids were like, is that right? Now, I'm obviously at that point going, no. No, it's not right. It's obviously crazy. But I think it's like, how do we have that? Is there space to have a tension that says, I'm modelling the importance of listening and modelling telling you what my opinion is? And that's, I wondered if there's something there, but you probably would say that's exactly what you were doing.
Yeah, that's what I hope the reflections are. And again, just reminding people that, and this is why I think it's because we're not used to it. Reminding people that just because I'm listening to someone with empathy and openness does not mean that I'm agreeing with them.
Doesn't mean you agree.
No. Yeah. Like, and if you look across this series, you will hear me listening to people with empathy and openness with views that are the polar opposite. So it can't possibly be true that yeah. I agree with everybody.
Yeah.
But let's come on to Gwen Adsted, because I think that helps us get to the heart of some of this thing. Because what you said was that is there some, and I could feel this pressing on the buttons of some of the listeners, and Gwen Adsted is this psychotherapist who works with violent offenders, essentially. And her incredibly sort of morally robust posture of empathy and curiosity and respect towards people who have done the most heinous acts in society is for a lot of people quite hard to listen to and interesting, right? And say a bit more about what that was pressing on for you.
I mean, I thought she was and is obviously a remarkable person, and as an example of empathy is outstanding. The thing I was wrestling with, I was, so the point she made is, who am I to judge, basically? Who am I to judge this person who's committed murder, a potentially appalling murder? And I think the thing she said was, they have committed murder, but under severe mental health difficulty, whereas I don't have that difficulty and I was mean to someone. So who am I to say I'm better or worse? Like, on one level, I'm like, yes, okay. But it feels a bit, I almost wanted to say, the broader point is, you are not a better person than that person in God's eyes. And so you're absolutely right to empathise and understand. But I worry a bit about creating a norm that suggests that it's, that we shouldn't be horrified by, like, sin, by murder. Like, so I'll give you an example that maybe we feel more comfortable with. I was chatting with friends about terrible tragedy, obviously, about the Grenfell fire. And we were talking about the evidence that had been given by the company, the various companies who hadn't taken action. And my friends were saying, yeah, but, you know, they're under pressure. You've got to get inside their heads. They're under pressure to make a profit. They're in a culture where people tell lies in those businesses. It's very hard. You know, are you saying that you, in that circumstance, wouldn't have gone along with the crowd? And I'm like, yeah, that is what I'm saying. And I was like, I know that makes me sound like a sort of arrogant person. But actually, I think the danger is by not saying, yeah, I would have stood up to it, we're saying to everyone else, including our children, it's okay to just go with it, because you don't have the strength. No one has the strength to oppose it. Whereas I'm like, no, like, apologies, that does make sound a bit like an idiot. But when I was at school, I was the kid who said, no, we're not going to leave that child. We're going to go sit next to him. And I think we all have the moral agency to do the right thing. Like, I don't want to throw the stone at the person who hasn't. That's not my job. But I do also want to encourage people, empower people to say, you can make the right choice. You can do the right thing.
Yeah. So I think there's a false binary here. And I see it playing out all the time. And I sit like, and the place I see it playing out most is in parenting. That there is this idea that you have, like, strict authoritative parents who teach their children what right or wrong are. And then, like, warm, cuddly, permissive parents who give lots of nice feelings but don't actually teach them what right or wrong are. The research shows both of those types of parenting are really unhealthy. That's authoritarian. That's permissive. What you want is authoritative parenting, which is incredibly clear on the boundaries and incredibly warm, kind, empathetic, and emotionally safe. And so how that works out, and I don't manage this all the time, but how this works out with my kids is like, you are so angry. I can see how frustrated you are. It's not okay to hit. Like, what else can we hit? But I don't then go, here's the punishment for hitting. I'm trying to teach right and wrong from the inside, not from the outside out of fear or shame. And so the shorthand for that is firm but kind. And I think what I am trying to model in public and what I think, and so we think with difference, we can either listen and be empathetic, but also just be mush and have no principles and no opinions. And the thing is, listening to people does risk us changing our minds on some things, which is why people don't want to do it. But if we've got like a deep enough sense of self and a deep enough sense of principles and commitments, then it is entirely possible to listen deeply, hospitably, and with empathy, and still be firm, right, about what we think and what we hold to. And not to get like super theological for those listeners who are not Christian, apologies for a second. I actually think this is what the gospel is, right? that the brokenness of human beings and our mistakes are real and they have real consequences. And there is enough love and kindness and compassion to come and get us. And those things can be true at the same time.
100%. 100%. I mean, that's the, like, I think the story of Jesus' teaching is beautiful. I find it just continually beautiful. Like the idea that a person is of just immense moral value, full stop. Right? And like separately, what have you done? What's happened here? Is that okay? Is that not okay? It's not okay. But like that's a different conversation. And intuitively, we kind of have a recognition of this. Like if a 2-year-old knocks over some Lego, we don't go, I like that 2-year-old less. Right? Like, but it's a 2-year-old. I love my 2-year-old. That was a bad thing to happen. I couldn't agree more. But I do think though, judgment of condemnation or criticism of someone's actions is to some extent respecting the person, because it's saying, like, one of the most motivating things someone can say to me is, I know you can do even better than that. I'm like, wow, thanks. And I would want to say to my kids, that was wrong. Tell me about it. What happened? I'm so sorry. You probably feel upset. Liz. And then, you know, you can do better than that. And I do expect you to, and I believe you can. Like, I think there's something sort of, oh, okay, yeah. Rather than, well, you know, that's probably the best I expect from you.
Yeah.
Given the circumstances.
Yeah, you can't help it because you've got no agency and you're not really responsible for anything.
Yeah, you've got mental health difficulties. I guess it would happen that you might murder someone. I'm stretching it a bit. But you know what I mean? I want to say you are loved. No, it's irrelevant what you did.
Yeah.
And I want to help you and bring comfort. But we also want to condemn what's happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Final question. Having come to an awareness of homophily or people like me syndrome in the world and in your own life, what do you do differently to keep it in healthy levels?
So some of it is like in stuff in my head. Like if we were talking about a bit, like just recognizing when I feel like I might be rejected, knowing that's just normal, not worrying about it and not turning that into being anti-people, and then instead throwing with. I think the second thing is, I do want to be in spaces where I'm going to talk to people who might seem different, because I find the thing that's in common often. And so for me, that's just trying to get involved, like joining clubs, getting involved with societies, sitting with people who I might not, whether at work or out of work, going to sit at the table that I might not normally sit at, and just trying to connect. These are small things, but if we all do small things, I think the world can be a much happier place.
Yeah. Thanks, John. What I'm leaving with is this thing that the trouble is about all the deep wisdom is you realize it's all been said before. But I think I have been thinking of homophily as some, like people like me syndrome as something to be resisted in me.
Right.
And you've made me realize we can possibly judo move it and be like, given that I have a tendency to like people like myself, rather than scanning the world for how they're different from me, how do I scan the world for how they're like me and use that as a connecting point? More in common after all.
Exactly. You put it much better than I put it. That's exactly it. I totally agree, Liz.
John Yates, thank you so much for talking to me on this special Sacred Reflection episode.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and our production team are Lizzie Harvey, Dan Turner, and Amari Yagandran. As always, really love hearing from you. Some of that conversation was provoked by your comments and questions on social media and other places. So be assured that I read and think about what you feedback to us. And in order to build on that even further, we are going to be doing in the new year another Q&A episode, Ask Me Anything, from your listeners. We did one of these last January. We really enjoyed it. We'll be announcing how you can send in your questions very soon. But meanwhile, just a heads up so you can be thinking about what you would like to ask. My final announcement is that this is the last series of The Sacred, but don't panic. We are going to be returning to a fortnightly rhythm, 2 episodes a month without series breaks. So we don't have these long periods where I don't get to talk to you during the year. That'll be kicking off in January, and I look forward to speaking to you then.